Yes, ma'am. Right. Absolutely. What are we going to, well, see what we're going to start with.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the General Government and Transportation Committee. It's Thursday, February the 22nd, 2001. At this time, I'm going to open a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 480. Patrick, tell us where we are with that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 480 allows resolutions passed by cities with a population of 2,000 or more to be effective in less than 30 days following adoption. It also declares an emergency, making the measure effective upon passage. ORS 221.310 provides that for all cities with populations of 2,000 or more, no ordinance, resolution, or franchise shall take effect until 30 days after its passage by the City Council and approval by the Mayor. Senate Bill 480 allows resolutions, but not ordinances or franchises, passed by cities with 2,000 or more to take effect in less than 30 days following adoption. And we have and there's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and we have two folks signed up to testify, and it's Peter Wells, who's from the city of Pendleton, and Christy Munson from the League of Oregon Cities.
Okay, we have their letters. I'll let you two decide who's going to go first and then proceed.
Thank you, Chair George, members of the committee. I will keep this succinct.
There you go.
My name is Christy Munson. I'm a senior staff associate with the League of Oregon Cities. My colleague here is Mr. Pete Wells. He's the city attorney for the city of Pendleton, and we're here to ask your support of Senate Bill 480. The League supports Senate Bill 480. It's a necessary housekeeping measure to update an antiquated law, and it allows our cities to govern responsibly. The current law imposes a 30-day waiting period on resolutions. That waiting period is unneeded and may possibly affect our local officials' ability to govern effectively. Resolutions are different than ordinances. We're not talking about ordinances. Resolutions generally do not address matters concerning the rights or interests of large numbers of people, such as ordinances do. Instead, they're used for such things as administrative actions, expressing support or opposition for federal or state legislation, things like that. In fact, many of our cities, if not most of them, did not know of this ORS and were currently passing resolutions without a 30-day effective period. So we were just that's why the League of Oregon Cities and our Legal Advocacy Committee recommends that we pass Senate Bill 480 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Wells. Yes, I'm Peter Wells. I'm city attorney for the city of Pendleton. You have my written comments highlighting just that this is apparently enacted in 1907 to put into effect some of the referendum provisions of the Oregon Constitution, and for some reason it only applies to cities of more than 2,000 people. We don't quibble with the 2,000 number. We don't quibble with the matters having to do with ordinances or with resolutions or franchises. We just, as Ms. Munson said, expect that resolutions, which generally are not of general applicability, should be able to be effective immediately without having to either fictitiously or otherwise declare an emergency. And my full comments are in the written paper.
Appreciate that. Do we have any questions for our guests? Thank you very much. Patrick, do we have anyone else signed up to speak?
No one else has signed up to speak, Senator.
Do we have anyone else in the audience who would like to speak to Senate Bill 480? Okay. Is the committee comfortable? Let's go ahead and go to work session.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing, and with the tap of the gavel, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 480. Senator
Carter. I think I'm going to want 480.
Yes. Okay. Is there no further questions? Senator Carter has moved Senate Bill 480 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion on Senate Bill 480? Okay. If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter.
Aye.
Senator Carter.
Aye.
Senator
Beverly.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 480 is hereby declared passed and will be sent forward with a due pass. And who would like to carry that?
I don't mind, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter will do it. And appreciate that. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 480. And with the tap of the gavel, we'll be into a Public hearing on Senate Bill 348.
Senate Bill 348 adds services related to architectural and engineering personal service contracts to list of subjects to be included in model public contract rules. RS 279.057 specifies rules that public agencies must follow when contracting with registered engineers, registered architects, and registered surveyors. Rules required by RS 279.057 relate to the selection of contractors, determination of contract scope of services, compensation level, and performance schedule. Senate Bill 348 adjusts current statute by adding and related services to the ORS subsection on architectural and engineering contracts. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. And we have Mr. Joe McNaught from the Department of Justice who has signed up to testify.
Joe, welcome. Good to have you here today.
Good afternoon, Chairman George, members of the committee. My name is Joe McNaught. I'm the acting attorney in charge of the business transactions section of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 348, which was pre-session filed at the request of the Attorney General. This bill is essentially a housekeeping measure to add this phrase related services to a specific statute, ORS 279-049, that currently just refers to architectural and engineering personal services contracts when it talks about the Attorney General's obligation to adopt model public rules. In the contracting community, what are known generally as A&E services include not only professional architect services, engineering services, but also a broad range of other construction management and construction related personal services such as land surveyors, construction managers, systems balancers, and so on. The problem with the law as it's currently enacted is that the Attorney General is directed to adopt model rules relating to screening and selection for architects and engineers. And the problem is that our rules are, we've interpreted that statute to restrict our rules just to that two narrow professional categories. The net result has been that many agencies have had to opt out of our rules, which they have an option to do, because they're not flexible enough for them because they don't meet their general public contracting needs, which is to include these other associated services in the same procurement process. So what this amendment basically would do would authorize the Attorney General in developing the screening and selection model screening and selection rules for architects, engineers, and the related services in that area, would authorize the Attorney General to adopt more usable rules that would affect that entire contract group. The type of services that are generally included within this ambit of A&E and related services are those that are currently found in the Department Administrative Services Administrative Rule that I've cited and quoted in my testimony. So that we could, on behalf of the Attorney General, attempt to adopt more user-friendly rules that many public agencies wouldn't have to opt out of, we request your support of Senate Bill 348.
Thank you, Joe. Any questions from our Senator Bessemer?
Just real quick, so I understand this. So that what you're basically asking for is more authority to write a broader rule that you don't currently have in statute, so that if you want to let a contract for engineering services, which also may require work by surveyors, you can't do it under that because it's too narrowly written. This would allow you to write rules that would uncover all those things.
Yeah, the public agencies who would end up adhering to our model public rules would have the ability to use those rules to contract with a general construction manager or a surveyor or a systems balancer. The way it stands now, because of the inflexibility in our rules and the statute, agencies like DOS and ODOT have basically had to adopt their own rules that in part adopt most of our rules, but they have to have their own rule to capture this slightly broader category.
Joe, we had, during interim, we had a House bill that was passed last session, and part of the discussion was whether we could integrate the operations of counties or cities and ODOT, you know, for maintenance. Part of the problem that we heard in testimony as we worked on a work group through the summer was that there were firewalls to not allow certain kinds of transactions to occur. Do you think that this would be fitting anything like that? In other words, a transfer of dollars for services rendered by a county or a city in exchange for something that ODOT was going to do for them in the future. Do you think this would apply?
This bill would have no impact,
upon
that issue. The only impact that this bill might have is if there are other public agencies who are currently opting out of the Attorney General's model public contract rules, instead of having to opt out of this particular provision, they could adopt all of the model public contract rules and not worry about it. So actually would relieve a burden upon local public agencies.
Great. Yes, Senator Carter.
Sometimes I'm very slow, so that's why I'm eating a little chocolate today, Joe. Give an example of some of the restrictions as to why they opt out of the rules that are presently in the that guides the Attorney General's office.
And again, just talking about the related services, the reason why, you know, basically under the model public rule contract rules, AG's model public contract rules, they used to be an opt-in system. Now they're an opt-out system. These attorney and architect screening and selection rules are a very small subset of a larger group of model public contract rules. In fact, they're put in an entirely separate division of the Oregon Administrative Rules. What would drive an agency opting out of the adoption of this particular division of our administrative rules on architect and engineering contracts would be an agency's would be saying, well, gee, I want to have screen, because they have to have their own screen and selection rules for personal services contractors. And what they'd like to do is to have one uniform system of screen and selection for all construction professionals, whether they're architects, engineers, project managers, or whatever. And what they would say is that we want to opt out. We really like your architect and engineers rule and how it runs the screen and selection process, because we think you put a lot of thought into it and it works under the statutes, but it's not flexible enough for us because it's not broad enough because it doesn't cover the surveyors.
So we basically have uniformity and standards to the process.
So what this would do is allow us to, yeah, bring more uniformity so that the public agencies could say, well, we're going to adopt all of the AG's rules or continue to adhere to all of the AG's model rules, because now this A&E rule works better for us.
Good. Joe, thank you very much. I don't think we have anyone else signed up. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify relative to Senate Bill 348? Okay, seeing none. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 348, and with a tap of the gavel, we'll be in a work session on Senate Bill 348.
Pleasure of the committee. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 348 to the floor with a due pass.
Vice Chair Metzger has moved Senate Bill 348 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Parno.
Aye.
Senator Messerly. Senator Metzger.
Aye.
Chair George.
Aye. Senate Bill 348 is considered duly passed by this committee, sent to the floor with a due pass, and Senator Metzger has agreed to carry it. Okay, I'm going to go right down to 349. I think we're okay there.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 348 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 349. Patrick, tell us where we are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 349 limits the Attorney General's view of agreements for interstate cooperation to agreements made by state agencies. It eliminates the requirement that non-state public agencies submit interstate agreements to the Attorney General. It also defines state agency for this section as any officer, board, commission, department, division, or institution in the executive or administrative branch of state government. Current law requires the Attorney General's review office to review any written agreement between public agencies in Oregon, including local public agencies and public agencies in other states. And we have Mr. Joe McNaught, again, from the Department of Justice.
Joe, welcome again. Tell us why we'd want to take away review.
Chairman George, members of the committee, for the record again, my name is Joe McNaught. I'm the acting attorney in charge of Department of Justice's Business Transactions Section in the General Counsel Division. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 349, which was a bill that was pre-session filed at the request of the Attorney General. This particular bill seeks an amendment to ORS 190-430. That is a statute that requires the Attorney General to review all interstate cooperation agreements between public agencies in Oregon and public agencies of other states. The law also states that the Attorney General's review of those agreements is a condition for those agreements to be effective. It doesn't require the Attorney General to approve those agreements, and in fact, if the Attorney General does nothing in 30 days, the agreements are deemed approved. But what the law does direct us to do is to review those agreements to see if they're compatible with state laws and are otherwise in appropriate form. That function is entirely appropriate, we believe, with respect to reviewing agreements between Oregon state agencies and any other public agency of another state. It is somewhat awkward for us to be reviewing agreements between, let's say, TriMet and CTRAN, because the Attorney General does not represent TriMet, and under ORS Chapter 180, which is one of the provisions in Chapter 180, says that the Attorney General is only supposed to provide advice to state officials. So we end up in this somewhat odd situation of reviewing agreements by local governments with agencies in other states. These local government agencies have their own attorneys and are entitled to rely upon their counsel, and we would encourage them to do so with regard to these types of interstate cooperation agreements. But we believe that it's an unnecessary step and an unnecessary burden for them to have to come to the Attorney General and for the Attorney General to have to respond to these agreements on behalf of local governments. We also suspect, but don't know for certain, that this law actually provides somewhat of a trap for local governments, because we're not always certain that every local government agreement actually gets sent to the Attorney General's office for review as the statute requires. And of course, we don't know if they don't send it to us. But I suspect that there probably are a certain number of agreements out there that technically may be invalid just because they lack the review by our office. So just to summarize again, we think it's entirely appropriate, and we should continue to review interstate agreements of state agencies, but not those of local government units.
Did this go back to probably early thought in the history of Oregon that we kind of needed to manage local governments, and that we would be kind of the authority determining constitutionality of those agreements or some issue like that? What kind of that is? Do you have a little history on it? It seems perfectly reasonable to me, but
I really, Chairman George, I don't know precisely to tell you with any definition the origin of this statute. I suspect that it may have come out of a concern some time ago that units of local government may be entering into unlawful agreements, and that rather than, and I think a policy choice was maybe made at that point, well, let's get the Attorney General involved instead of insisting that the local government maybe seek review by its own counsel. I assume that was the policy choice was made.
Great. Any questions from our committee?
I think it's wonderful
paying
you guys
for money. Yeah. We're playing attorney for other people.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, without the authority, apparently,
exactly.
Under 180.
Exactly.
Okay, Joe, thank you again. And I'm going to now close the public hearing on Senate Bill 349 with the tap of the gavel. We'll be in a work session.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 349 to the floor with a due pass.
Vice Chair Miskers moves Senate Bill 349 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Fryer?
Aye.
Senator Farno?
Aye.
Senator Mesrui?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 349 has been sent to the floor with a due pass, and Senator Farno, would you like to carry it? If not, I'll do it. Okay. Senator Farno will carry Senate Bill 349. At this time, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 349, and with a tap of the gavel, we'll be into a public hearing on Senate Bill 347. Patrick, tell us a bit about where we are on the 347.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 347 restricts the authority of the Attorney General to expand or reduce the scope of work required by a contract ratified by a state agency prior to the approval of the Attorney General. It also specifies circumstances in which state agencies may ratify a contract under which work has been performed prior to the approval of the contract by the Attorney General. Current statute allows the state agency, allows the Attorney General to ratify contracts under which services are being performed before final contract approval by the Attorney General. If the Attorney General determines that the contract is legally sufficient, the Attorney General has the authority to require that the contract be amended as necessary to become legally sufficient as a condition of final approval. Proponents of Senate Bill 347 contend that the authority of the Attorney General to amend contracts as necessary to make the contract legally sufficient can be construed in a manner that undermines the legal sufficiency requirement. Senate Bill 347 addresses this issue by restricting the Attorney General's power to approve additional work when approving contracts for legal sufficiency. There is a no revenue impact and no fiscal impact for this measure, and Joe McNaught of the Department of Justice, once again, has been the lone person to sign up for the to testify.
Joe, come on back up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman George, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe McNaught. I'm the acting attorney in charge of the business transactions section of the General Counsel Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here today to speak in support of Senate Bill 347, which is a bill that was pre-session filed at the request of the Attorney General. Perhaps it might be helpful if I just gave a little background for this particular bill and the proposed amendment to this statute. Under Oregon law, certain public contracts of state agencies must be reviewed and approved for legal sufficiency by the Attorney General before the contract is effective and work can begin on the contract. Not all contracts have to be reviewed, but many of them do have to be reviewed for legal sufficiency. The 1999 legislature enacted ORS 291.049, which is this particular statute that this bill proposes to amend. The gist of that particular statute is to basically allow a relief valve that if an agency has entered into a contract and performance has begun under that contract, but the agency has failed to obtain legal sufficiency review, nevertheless, they can come to the Department of Justice, ask us to review the contract or have it amended to make it legally sufficient. And we would then at that point approve it for legal sufficiency. And the final step is that the state agency then turns around and ratifies what previously was an invalid contract because it lacked the appropriate approvals. They ratify that contract and make it valid just as if it was valid from the beginning. And this, as a general concept, we believe that this is a good idea to have this escape valve because people, you know, are human and sometimes they forget to come to the Department of Justice for the appropriate approvals. What has concerned us in the interim and looking at this particular law as it was enacted is that through this process, it prescribes a process whereby if they're operating under a contract and the statute doesn't specify whether or not has to be any form of writing or not. They can come to us and say, gee, we need to have this contract approved for legal sufficiency, and the statute also authorizes us to require certain amendments to make it legally sufficient. The concern is that this, what was designed to be, I think, a fairly narrow escape valve, actually presents the potential for significant abuse, and that a state agency could be entering into oral contracts for, let's say, information services or something. It goes on for hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they go, oops, or they have a poorly written contract, and they go, oops, we've got to come and get this amended, plus they had a written contract, and maybe they added a large number of items to the scope of work, and they want to come to us and have us work with them to develop an amendment and basically end up blessing a contract that doesn't represent, or a contract situation that doesn't represent some innocent errors in terms of just failing to get the appropriate approvals, but a blatant disregard of the public contracting process. And so the purpose behind this particular amendment is to somewhat restrict our own authority, the authority of the Attorney General, in terms of what we can approve for legal sufficiency in the ratification context. It specifies that the parties must have had some kind of written agreement that they are bringing to us at some point in the process, so that we can look at that and know what each party was expecting. I think this provides benefits to the agency and to the contractor. They should be on notice that they need to at least be working with a written contract in some form, particularly if they're exceeding the legal sufficiency amounts. The second thing is that in making the amendments should just be those things that are required to make the contract legally sufficient. The amendments shouldn't be to greatly expand the scope of work beyond what the contracting agency and the contractor originally anticipated. And so basically what we're proposing in this amendment is to restrict it to ratification of contracts that were written, and that when we're reviewing that contract and insisting upon certain amendments, that we're only insisting upon the amendments that are necessary to make it sufficient, and that we don't bless major changes in the scope of work under the contract. There's also a third component to this bill in that it authorizes the Attorney General, but doesn't require, authorizes the Attorney General to look at any payments that may have been made under this contract to evaluate whether or not those payments, this is payments that were made before it was appropriately approved, whether or not those payments are in fact consistent with the contract that we ultimately end up approving. That has some benefit to the agency because they get some comfort, at least if we say, yeah, this is in fact consistent. You've spent this money, which you should not have done. We're allowing this ratification. We're looking at these payments, and we think that these are all consistent. Another possibility, though, is that, and again, this doesn't require us to do this in every instance, but we have the discretion to look at this and say, no, your contract with this person that you failed to get approved and that we can't approve now after we've made certain changes to it to make it legally sufficient was for X, and you've paid them for both X and Y. You've overpaid, and we need to talk to the contractor about making certain adjustments or repayment of amounts that were improperly paid outside the scope of the approved contract. So that's the third component of this. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Mm-hmm. I know this.
Senator Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. 2 out of 3 is not bad, because this one sounds like there's so much circularity in it and so much contradiction that I had a headache along the road. And what I'm saying is that, and I understand what you're saying in the sense that once they have ratified a particular and then it's too much money, or they've overpaid, you can say, yes, you've overpaid, now we're going to step in top of the contractor. But I think you put a contractor who has put some money out on this in a particular situation where it's not a win-win for everybody. I like win-wins, you know, and this bill doesn't sound like it. I'm just confused. Are the rest of you guys on top of this?
Well, that thought crossed my mind. And Joe, it, obviously, if a contractor performed some work for the state and maybe they didn't have the proper written agreement and you felt it was outside of that, I mean, they must have some sort of cause to move forward for collection of work done because it was authorized. It just, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, I'll try and respond to both of you. And both of your concerns, and I think that you have identified some of the policy decision points here. What and there's some balancing that has to be considered, and it's where you come out in that balancing in terms of and that drives your ultimate policy decision. Now, what was the situation prior to the ratification statute was you actually had a situation where a contractor could sign an agreement with an agency or be operating in good faith and think they had an agreement with an agency and perform certain services, and then it turns out that the contract wasn't approved. It wasn't either approved by the appropriate person of the agency or Department of Administrative Services, or perhaps most significantly, it didn't get it approved for legal sufficiency. Now, there are cases that say that the contractors are charged with knowledge of the law. You know, they're dealing with the state of Oregon. They're dealing with the public contracting process. They should know what the requirements are. But that ends up with harsh results in certain instances. So the original idea behind the ratification statute was let's allow, if there is an agreement and services have been performed prematurely, let's have a mechanism to basically ratify and approve those agreements. The concern is that the balance has maybe gone too far, that we want to maintain integrity of the public contracting process. We don't want people, either contractors or state agencies, to be basically acting cavalierly towards the public contracting process and the public contracting requirements and say, well, you know, if this comes to light or if somehow we mess up, we'll always fix it later. And sometimes later, we haven't had recent examples of this, but prior to the legal sufficiency review requirements, back in the earlier 90s, we had many bad examples of public contracts that just ran amok. So the concern behind this particular, that's driving this particular proposal, is that the policy choice in deciding, where we're going to allow the grace and what we're going to allow the ratification on, it needs to be constrained to situations where we actually have a written contract. Now, and that's one trigger point, the written contract. The second trigger point would be that the amendment can't greatly expand the scope of work beyond what was originally contemplated. That's another decision point. And then we have the third component, which is just looking at the payments. But in terms of the actual review, I think that those are the two decision points, and the policy choice to be made is in the balance between, cavalier contracting practices and being extraordinarily harsh on contractors who maybe should know better but didn't. Let's strike some middle ground. And that's what this particular proposal represents, is an attempt to rein in the potential for basically deferring the legal sufficiency review in many cases.
Senator Carter, are you okay? Joe, let me ask you one question. It would appear to me that before we put a contractor in that kind of harm's way, that we would make sure that all of our agency contracting folks would be well informed about the requirement of a sufficient contract. I mean, does Attorney General do those kind of workshops saying, here's what you need to have?
Yes. And this, but this is a constant struggle, or effort and challenge. We have in recent years tried to improve the quality of public contracting by the state of Oregon, and I think tremendous efforts have been made, not only in making the contract process more efficient in many respects, but also end up with higher quality products and end up with better results for agencies through contracting in terms of requiring far more specific statements of work. And we are attempting to do, we have our annual or biannual public law conferences where we always put on public contracting. We provide contract training to agencies on request. This is something that, you know, we're very interested in doing with agencies. The problem is that the contracting varies from agencies, and standards and abilities vary from agency to agency. Some agencies will do fine, then they have turnover. People get hired away by the private sector, and they have turnover in their contract officers. I think every contract officer is well aware of the need for legal sufficiency on contracts. Sometimes they get confused in the course of administration of contracts. Sometimes the field folks for an agency who are just interested, they want results. They're not worried about the niceties of contracting. Sometimes they get ahead of the contract officer.
That's Senator Carter.
I got it.
You got it?
I got it.
Okay, are you comfortable with it, though?
If a state agency does a contract with a contractor, a contractor is excited, they're going to get started on the contract. They can do it. They can get started, but they still have to go to the Attorney General for complete ratification for effectiveness. And then the Attorney General cannot add or take away any more money from that contract already that has been made between those two people. And ratification would have taken place between these two agencies, and you just further do it once they enter into this contract. Did I get it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, I think you've captured it, but and I want to point out that this is one of the key components here, and it's something that you and other members of the committee and the Legislative Assembly want to consider, and that is that the deal between the state agency and the contractor under this proposal would have had to have been a written deal. They couldn't have just, you know, called the phone and say, you know, Charlie, I need, you know, give me that IT program or design that building for me or whatever, and we'll work the paperwork out later. And $200,000 in expenses, they realize they're over for that particular contract, be a $75,000 limit. Oops, we need to get legal sufficiency review. That one would be, that would be a contract under this proposal we would not be able to ratify. Now, if they had sat down and at least reduced some of the basic terms and concepts of the deal to writing, and it's insufficient, let's say, in respects in terms of complying with other conditions of Oregon law, but nevertheless was the basics of the deal was reduced to writing. They basically understood what was going to be paid, how it was going to be paid, and what the scope of work was going to be. However artful it was, they had some writing. Then in that case, and they mess up and don't ask for legal sufficiency, then in that case they could come to us and say, oops, we've got a problem here. Here's our written contract. We know it probably doesn't meet all of the needs. We're sorry. We didn't get it to you before. And under our ratification rules, they have to explain why it didn't come to us and basically what they're going to do to stop this from recurring in the future as a condition of us ratifying it. But and then in that case, we could ratify it. But if we have the situation that, you just talked about where maybe somebody starts out, either there's no written contract, and they just have the telephone call, and maybe the contractor is working in good faith, and maybe the agency person is working both ignorant of the law. In that particular case, if it triggered the legal sufficiency limits, then the contractor, could pay a price for not at least having it reduced to writing and not being aware of the law's governing relationship with the state. So that's the issue here. The concern from our standpoint is and again you come to where the balance is that if agencies just instead of doing things properly, getting the agreements in order, figuring out exactly, because the devil is often the details in these, particularly with regard to the statement of work, what do I really want? And it's best to determine that, you know, early on instead of 3 or 4 months into the contract, that the value to the state and the benefit to the state is the greatest when things are worked out at the beginning. And so our approach to this is to try and reach some middle ground, but do it in a way that perhaps some people will get hurt, but we will also have the benefit of greatly encouraging responsible contracting practices. So,
Joe, could I get you to stand by? I think we have someone that would like to maybe talk about this, because where I'm having my trouble,
sure,
and that is on the last half of line 18 through 19, and of course completing with 20, as to whether in fact the Attorney General might determine that the retention of any consideration by the contractor might be outside, even though they in good faith performed as they were asked by agency.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Harris. I'm here on today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. And we share your concern, Mr. Chair. Unfortunately, sometimes legal sufficiency review takes a while, and we certainly agree that a contractor who enters into a contract and starts doing work without anything written down should probably know better. However, if they do have something written down and it is found to be outside the scope of their authority, I guess we're concerned that if we start entering into contracts, and especially smaller contractors that do only little parts of public work every once in a while, and that's true around the state, especially for smaller agencies that are working in good faith, I guess my concern is that those contractors who are working with what they see as a written document and what they believe to be a sufficient document may be asked to return monies for services provided. And I don't think that that's necessarily the intention of the Department of Justice. I think their concerns are valid, not wanting to ensure that both contractors and public agencies are working under the same set of documents for the right reasons. But I think this bill may have some unintended consequences for contractors and public agencies who believe that they're acting in good faith and who intend for those services to be covered. But at the end of the day, because of the way it was written at the beginning, it's not, and all of a sudden the contractor is being asked to return monies for services they already provided and that they would have provided if the document had been written correctly. And so that's my concern, and we'd be happy to work with the Department of Justice to ensure that that isn't the way that the bill's written in a way that it prevents that instance from occurring.
Jessica, I think that's a great idea, and I'm going to ask you guys to work on that, because the first thing that popped into my mind is when we lost the Highway 101 at Cape Foulweather, at the same time we had problems on 226, and the State Highway 226,
And we had a contractor that said, hey, I thought I had authorization to do this, and I believe, and you may know better than I, that they actually ended up in this set of circumstances, their urgency to join with ODOT to get the road opened up, and there was a disagreement as to whether they were within the contract. Is that a reasonable example?
Senator George, I believe it is, and those are the kinds of things that happen, especially as they relate to change orders on public work and other circumstances, especially emergency contracts where people come in and they're doing what they believe they have authority to do, or in the case that it's a sketchy contract, you know, I just need something fixed, or I need these supplies right away, and oops, we're outside the scope of the authority, and I just would hate to see that happen, and I don't think that's the intent of the Department of Justice either.
Yes, Senator Carter.
There is further collaboration in my mind, that's not the problem in the first place. Both sides need protection, because if a public agency, a state agency, would be acting with a contractor in good faith, but has not sought the legal sufficiency issue to the greatest degree, then I'd hate for somebody to say, oops, sorry, you got to pay, but then I don't want you guys as a private entity to have to pay. Even so, some kind of way, Joe, that was my concern. How do we protect both entities? Would be my issue. And that's why I said so much circularity. And so where are both entities protected under the law? And if we need to do a better job teaching our agencies more responsibility, consequently more accountability, then we need to do it up front before the legal sufficiency issue is an issue. And so they need to be knowing how to deal with contracts. Believe you me, this last year, in 1999, when I inherited an agency of $689,000 negative debt, it told me that folks didn't know how to deal with contracts. And so somebody's going to pay because there's no such a thing as a free lunch. But how do we do the teaching on this end but not penalize the agencies, the public contractors on the other end? That's my concern.
Yes, Senator Metzger.
Thank you. Mr. McNaught, I don't think you were the one that testified on this before. This is all coming back to me now because I carried this bill 2 years ago. And I'm thinking, okay, why are we changing all this stuff? Because I remember, as I recall, because there was two major issues here, and one of the things I'm curious about is, since you'll be working on this, maybe address some of these things, but I'm also curious for information-wise. There's two points brought up, and Mr. Chair, we had this in business committee last year, and DCBS and others were talking on this, for and the Attorney General, there was two points, number one of which we dealt with the issue of the limit, so they didn't have to have contract sufficiency for, like, home health care where you need somebody to go in right away and all that. But as I recall, the testimony on this bill that we're now being asked to modify again was kind of addressing some of the points that Senator Carter had pointed out, and basically what we flushed out was a lot of agencies were just going ahead and doing contracts without getting legal sufficiency and trying to rein them in from doing these things against what they were supposed to be doing in the first place. And they said, oh, we'll get it retroactively. But there's two questions I had on this. Number one is, the amendment, I'm just curious why you've added this about not expanding or reducing the scope of work under the contract. Since we revived this 2 years ago, has there been some experience with this in terms of the scope of work that brought this to your attention since? That's my first question.
I think history,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, you're correct. I didn't testify about this bill 2 years ago. The person who testified is now working for Tektronix, so that's why I'm the acting attorney in charge of the business transactions section, filling this role temporarily. In terms of history on the ratification, we have not seen many ratifications. We're not 100% certain of why we haven't seen a lot of ratifications, but we have not seen a large number of ratifications. But what, and this concept, I think, was germinated 6 to 9 months ago, and we hadn't even adopted our we have since adopted some ratification rules that deal with this particular process. I think the concern about the scope of work is or was a concern that isn't so much based on experience under this particular statute, but based upon prior experiences and what agencies had done, let's say, in the early to mid-90s, and that what was anticipated was that what has happened in the past is that agencies will start with a project and then it's like a Christmas tree. You know, they've got it open and then they start throwing ornaments on it. And I want to stress that this is the exception and it's not the rule.
It happens in the legislature every July. I mean that's okay.
And the concern was, and maybe we can address, you know, some of these, and we're happy to have a discussion with Associated General Contractors on this, and we welcome, you know, any discussions that can improve this for everybody's mutual benefit. But what was driving this was that an agency should be looking at their initial deal, and that's what they should be coming to us with. Whether we end up being so harsh as to say it has to have been, you know, the level of writing it had to have been, or maybe it could have been oral, but they followed up later on a writing, or we can explore those things. But that what they shouldn't be doing is using all of a sudden, oh, great, we can get this thing ratified, and so basically we've taken this project that started out to be quite narrow, and we've allowed it to completely balloon. And that's beyond the scope of what was initially decided between the parties. And so the concern was is that these amendments, we shouldn't be allowing amendments that greatly expand after the fact the scope of work beyond that which was originally anticipated.
Yeah, I understand that, and I appreciate that. I'm just wondering why the Attorney General didn't see that when they wrote it the first time, too.
Well,
that's my funny point there, because that was not an issue there. I just wanted to ask one other thing, and just point out one other thing, and Mr. Renaud, if I'm incorrect, please let me know, because Senator Carter was talking about this, and you might contribute too. Because I remember we had the discussion about contractors doing prior work. As I understand how we wrote it then and how it thus is now, while you're talking about the issue of maybe having to ask for money back from a contractor, the way it is now, they can perform work and not get paid at all. They're taking a chance that they take a contract and then it turns out not to be legally sufficient, they may not even get any money, much less get money and be asked to take it back. Is that correct? Is that, as I recall, is how it currently is?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Excuse me, Senator Metzger. Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, that's correct.
It works. Thanks.
Okay. Well, Joe, let me tell you where my heartburn is, and you help me out here. We were doing some work on the processing plant, and my wife said, could I have that contractor come up and do some things around the house? And I said, sure, absolutely, sounds good. We talked about it. He went beyond what either Kathy or I thought he was going to do, but you know what? It was really a nice thing that was done. And we paid him for every bit of the work that he did. If there was going to be a dispute between my wife and I as to whether or not we should have done it, that would have been one thing. That would have been in-house. But the person who did the work literally has a right to be paid. And that's my problem here, is if we have an agency who's going on beyond or pushing a contractor to do something, saying, oh, yeah, don't worry, we can make it work, we should discipline that agency contractor, pay the person who actually did the work, the private contractor here in this case. But then discipline that person in-house rather than dragging them back in and putting the very fact that they paid their employees, they paid their taxes and everything else to perform this job, and then with the fear that, in fact, they may not be paid. I tell you what I would do. If I was contracting with you and I had to happen one time, I'd build 10 or 15% into every contract, assuming that would happen.
Chairman George, if I may just respond briefly to that scenario, what we have, the Attorney General has adopted rules as authorized by this statute and the companion statute to implement the legal sufficiency review process. And as part of those rules, and this also responds somewhat to a question earlier of Senator Carter, as part of those rules, we have exempted from legal sufficiency review a fair number of types of agreements where there's not a lot of risk, that we think that this type of agreement really doesn't need legal sufficiency review in these particular circumstances, or that work can proceed pending legal sufficiency review. And there's some rules that address emergency situations, so we don't end up with them. I don't know specifically about your landslide issue, and there may be some nuances I'm not familiar with, but we have rules that attempt to address a number of these questions. We have rules that address the change order situation, where in construction, change orders can be up to 10% of the total value of the contract, or 33% in total before they ever have to come back for a legal sufficiency review, to build in some flexibility so that when you have somebody out in the job and they're pouring that pillar or something, and they want to know, do you want it 3 feet or 4 feet, and you say five, that it can be covered, so we don't get hung up there. Again, the challenge is this balance, because I think that the contractors have some, and particularly, you know, a lot of these contractors, sophisticated businesses, some of them are not, but many of them are, they've got their own responsibility to be looking at our public contracting rules and understanding with whom they're dealing and working with us together to end up with a responsible and positive work product. And so I think that the challenge is to, as I said before, to reach that balance to protect the public welfare, make sure we're not too deep into bad deals, which is another problem with after-the-fact legal sufficiency review, bad from a legal standpoint, but nevertheless deal fairly, or as fair as is reasonable under the whole scheme of things with the contractors. So I think we share the same concerns. It may be that we've got to do some work to refine this to try and address some of the concerns that we've more recently identified and address your concerns.
Joe, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask you and Jessica to work together to try to come up with some amendments in about, so we can have this back in about 2 weeks. But at the same time, I'm also going to make available to anyone who's watching or hearing this, hearing today, that if you're a smaller contractor that may not be a member of a large organization like AGC, and you have some concerns about this, for them to bring forth their ideas to this committee, to our committee administrator, and then we will convey them to you two to try to get a framework together that will address this, because I think we do have a little bit of a problem here. And I think you can see by the committee that we'd like to see this clarified a little bit. We don't ever want to be in the business of putting a person who in good faith has done something for the state as a contractor only to find themselves not being paid. Very, very important when you're paying payrolls and paying taxes that if you've operated in good faith, you'd be compensated. So with that, any further comments? We'll look forward to the good work of you two. And with that, is there anything else to come before the committee? If not, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 347 with a tap of the gavel. We will be adjourned.